Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we're going to talk with David Connor, whose first book is Oh God, the Sun Goes. It's published today, whatever today is, August 1st. You may be listening to it on a later date. It's published by Melville House, which is an incredible publishing house. They're doing all kinds of great work. And also, I should mention, David's going to be down at A Novel Idea, which is a great bookstore on Passyunk. I think it's 1726 East Passyunk. And that's on Sunday, August 6th, starts at 4 p.m. So, what is the ineffable? First of all, I can't describe it because when something is, it's indescribable. Describing ineffability would be the same as trying to describe the eye that is observing the sun with that very eye, like the eye. So Kurt Gödel's theorem of incompleteness makes it clear that you can't describe accurately any system in which you are. And just as a closed book contains nothing until it is opened and the page is observed, the words perceived, recognized, parsed, and understood, we don't really ever know what we are because we're inside of the system. So it's kind of impossible to compute. And the sun is something that could never be missed until it was gone. And in its place, a circle that's the color of nothing. Mr. Blue, who may really not be Mr. Blue at all, finds himself in a world of his own making, as do we all. And in it, something ineffable is missing, and that something is the sun, but it's also something else. And in this picaresque novel, a novel with an appendix that actually describes the locus, you don't find an appendix in a novel that actually describes the locus and nature of human consciousness, perhaps. And then we also learned about Del Webb, who I knew about before. He's like the Elon Musk of retirement vehicles. And if we pay particular attention, we may also learn that the best sleeping posture, better than you can get with the sleep number system, is that of lying perfectly still on your back, balancing an egg on your forehead. Sleeping soundly, as the physician says, for a night or forever, and hopefully being able to wake up and fry the egg that's sitting there. So if we're brave enough to live without a sun, then we're brave enough to join David today on a trip to Phoenix and the mind with a capital N, M, not N, both places that meet, indeed ask us to forget them. So welcome, David, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is cool.
So you had said somewhere else that you were kind of messing with the reader. And I understand that because I think it's really cool. But actually, it's not just messing with the readers, it's messing with the reader's head, right?
Yeah, I think I was a bit flippant that day when I said I was messing with the reader. But I do, I think I was interested in writing a story that was set in the mind or set in a kind of brainscape. That wasn't necessarily interested in the kind of scientific approach of reducing our understanding of the brain to sort of concrete regions that have specific functions, but more so in kind of reveling in the mystery of it and the kind of creating this sort of overwhelming nebulous quality that the mind and brain is to me. And so more so than messing with the reader, I think I was interested in planting these clues or these roads that the reader could go down and maybe led to dead ends or maybe led to some interesting thoughts. But I think I was invested in writing something that kind of unraveled as opposed to kind of came together.
Well, you weren't flippant, I don't think, in the interview when you said, as I said in the introduction, about talking about the ineffable, because the ineffable, and this is where the book kind of turns in on itself, is indescribable. It is transcendent and beyond words, but it's also like celestial and divine too. And so when you talk about ineffable, and I don't mean this as a compliment, but it is, like it's kind of Kafkaesque in a certain way, or a lot like the Russians, because Well, you tell me. You tell me why it's ineffable and why you want it to be ineffable.
Yeah, I think I was concerned with mood and atmosphere and really a feeling of that kind of horrible loss. That is the sun going missing. That is like the center of one's world not being there and grappling with that. And I just think that experience that many of us go through in different ways, there's a quality to it that is senseless. And I think at getting at the truth of that mood or that atmosphere, or that grief experience, yeah, I think it just felt like the truth of that mood was to not really understand the world anymore.
You know, I was just thinking, since I mentioned Kafka, I just thought of this. You know, your characters, other than the Mr. Blue, which we'll talk about too, is, you know, she's M and he's RA. So you decided, you know, you made a conscious decision not to use names. How come?
Yeah, I think it was part of this sense of the incompleteness of this world, this way in which not just the sun, but language itself has sort of become lost or fragmented, and that even people's names or identities are just letters pointing to something larger that isn't there. Yeah, and I think also there's something about like letters that feel like kind of basic, or just the letter M is the sort of, and like it's one of the first letters that kids learn, I think. And there's something about that kind of childlike grasping for language that felt important to this story.
There's another thing that was kind of, I guess, a gnomon of the book for me, which was picking the name Mr. Blue, and then we can go into music too, because it reminds me of like Dylan's Mr. Jones, which was then David Byrne's Mr. Jones, and then the Counting Crows Mr. Jones, kind of like an everyman. But then, I don't know, is he an everyman? I kind of felt like he was.
It's a good question. I mean, I love the Fleetwoods, the band, and their song Mr. Blue. I really love an everyman. Yeah, I mean, I think I like Mr. Blue in part, this kind of metaphor of like the sun missing in the sky, right? The sky is blue, and then Mr. Blue as this sort of sunless sky, or this like incomplete thing. An everyman. Yeah, I do think maybe an everyman or maybe a no man kind of character. I think, yeah, part of the device of HA or Mr. Blue not having a memory kind of, I think, created this kind of archetype that anyone could kind of attach to theoretically.
Yeah, and even though, like you were saying, it's flippant, but messing with, you know, I'm the reader, I can do whatever I want. So I definitely identified with it, because I often have the same thoughts that he has. Like once when I was tripping, I looked at a book and I had no idea. I looked at it, what is this? I can't understand this jumble of things. And it scared the hell out of me. But yeah, there were many times during the book that I felt as if I was him. And I guess that's one of the marks of a really good book, because, you know, just like everything else, you're inside of it.
That's right. Did you feel messed with when you were reading it?
Twists and turns. Yeah, I don't want to do spoilers. It's actually a good book for not doing spoilers, because there really aren't any, except for like one thing. Yeah, one thing.
That one thing.
Yeah, it's just one thing, which I won't even talk about. But yeah, that I went, oh, no, okay. And then it became, you know, like, then it became romantic, and romantic in a way that many of us can feel.
Mm.
It's happened to.
Mm.
So yes, but I guess, I don't know, you were flipping, maybe I'm being flippant too. I think the books I like are the ones that mess with your head, because otherwise you're just reading, you know, trash. I mean, the books on my front table are all, you know, Colleen Hoover, or books that are like, which you don't even know, but they're just books that people like to read at the beach. That's why they're beach reads, or chick lit, or something like that. I shouldn't be saying all this. But anyway, yeah. So I would much rather have a book where at the end you close the book, the letters aren't there anymore, and you're still thinking about it, which I guess you had that in mind too.
That's right. Yeah, I like that too. I think my least favorite kind of book is one that traps you in it. I'd much rather something kind of unravel you and leave you foggy than like a kind of overdetermined narrative that tells you the world is horrible, or that the world is all good, or yeah. I think I tend to be allergic to fiction that kind of traps you in what it's trying to do to you.
Yeah, it's like a lot of books, most of them actually are boxes, like you say, trapping. It's like when the book is over, that's it. You've been inside the book, or maybe you've been inside the book, but there's nowhere to go afterwards. It's just four walls or a little box, like you said. But some people like it. They like it. Box, wrapping paper, a ribbon, and then they're done and they've accomplished what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing about, I mean, this is the first book that I'm putting into the world. And it's, I don't know, it's scary for it to be like, you know, for people to read it with all different aesthetics that aren't necessarily my own. And I think I'm used to sharing my writing with generally like-minded readers aesthetically. So it's interesting putting it out there and you know, learning what different readers are like. I mean, I guess, so you run a bookstore. You must have a sense of what readers are like at this point.
Yeah, I mean, my demographic is all over the place, but you know, I also have used books, and I've said this many times, I have book ladders, which I always wanted. I have a book ladder in my library here. Mm-hmm. And so when some kid like climbs up the ladder and he's looking for something, he finds it, but then he also sees the book on either side of the book he's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I really like, because it's one of those that could, like, which it did for me, change everything, whether it's Dostoevsky or even like Ayn Rand, whatever you think of her, it's still something that all of a sudden it changes your life, right? It does. With me, like, it was science fiction guys like Robert Heinlein, which reminds me of a story he wrote called The Year of the Jackpot, which you should read because it's a lot like this. And another one, like your book, is called I Am the Cheese by Robert Cormier, which is a young adult book, but it's really good. But anyway, and answering your question, yeah, there's lots and lots of different readers, and I'm attracted to some. And I have the luxury of saying, don't buy this book, it sucks.
Right. So, yeah, how often do you whip out that line?
I don't know. The staff hates it, obviously. So whenever I go in there in order to insult and irritate people. And if they're really irritating, telling them to leave my bookstore, I'll give them $20 if they leave. I can do all kinds of stuff like that. All right, let's go back to selling your book, I guess. So, So Sun City, which my brothers and I are in the building business, and we actually built a 55 and up retirement, a 55 and up place where you have all these amenities like shuffleboard and that kind of stuff.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, so Del Webb started all of that. He was the guy who started all of it. He figures in your book in a big way. And so we talked about this a little bit before we started, but Sun City, especially the fact that the concentric aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
goes to the fact that there's really cool maps in the book. But what is it about Sun City that made you decide, other than the fact that it contains the word sun?
Mm. Yeah, well, I mean, I lived in Southern California for about 8 years, and I spent a lot of time in the Southwest and Arizona and New Mexico. And I think coming from the East Coast, it was like very alien to me. And particularly these sort of like housing developments that seem so kind of out of place, or kind of, you know, Sun City as this kind of utopic retirement community with green lawns and man-made lakes and whatnot. And there was something about those towns and cities seeming so kind of divorced from where they were located, and particularly divorced from like the history of where they were located. I find often in the Southwest, there's like, because it's the desert and because of its history, there's this real presence of absence. And there's a strong indigenous community that's there. And there's also this sense in which these towns like Sun City or the city of Phoenix feels so divorced from that history. And there's this kind of amnesia that I think sets in when you go to a town like Sun City, where there's this relatively new development, you know, the 60s, that has its own museum and has this own myth of itself, but has no connection to what was there before. And I felt that kind of mirrored also the narrator's kind of personal romantic amnesia, this fog that the narrator's in, this kind of fissure from his history, from his past, that he's unable to grapple with quite yet. And so I felt like there was something about a painful past that one is not facing that felt both relevant to the narrator as well as to that region and the sorts of cities that are there, such as Sun City, which feels like such a dream to be in. I don't know. Have you visited a Sun City before?
I see the signs in the script, but I haven't gone inside. There's so many of them now. Mm-hmm. But right. The thing that's interesting is that, you know, one review compared it to, like, I don't know, like gonzo journalism, like yours was like Hunter Thompson, Fear and Loathing, mm-hmm. because the museum you describe is if you didn't know anything about this, you wouldn't believe that museum, because it's just the first house and it looks like, okay. And then you're describing exactly what it is. So it's like, you know.
Yeah, that's the, I didn't, most of the book is sort of, you know, kind of sheer kind of creation from thin air, but that museum of all things, which is maybe one of the most fantastical things of the book, is pretty accurate to what it's really like there.
Yeah. And everybody is happy.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, another way of looking at it is I was driving with my dad one time when we drove past this subdivision, because we subdivision communities, and I didn't like it. And I thought, oh, this is crap. And I said, look at this crap. And he goes, how dare you say that? There's people living there and they're happy. Mm. Who are you to do this? You know? And I thought about that when I read the book too.
I think that surprised me when I wrote the book, was I went in with this sort of menacing attitude a bit with Sun City, or you know, its founder. And I think, without any spoilers, and I don't think this is a spoiler, I think it was, it felt truer to kind of find the humanity in it as well, even in this, like, you know, there is something actually also kind of sweet about the characters in that town, I think.
Oh, which reminds me of, like, Del Webb's, and I won't spoil it either, his dream, which is also the dream of the doctor. And that does mess with you, because all of a sudden the doctor is doing something weird, and then later on he's doing something even weirder, because there he is, and then you got to decide whether that's where you are too.
Yeah.
Talk about the doctor before. Just talk about it so we don't go.
Sure. Yeah. Well, there's a doctor, Dr. Higley, Dr. H.A. Higley, who the narrator learns about very early on as a sort of expert on the sun, who seems to know where it's gone. And some hope for the narrator that he'll be able to solve the puzzle and kind of return to the world that he's missing. Yeah, I think in some ways the character is like, it's fun. It's hard to talk about the book without giving it away. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the character is like a hint. I think it, yeah, I don't want to give anything away, but I do think the doctor kind of hints at a direction the book could go in, like a sort of maybe more straightforward neuroscience mystery book where the doctor has the, you know, the clues that will lead the reader or the narrator to an answer. And I think what ends up happening is the doctor becomes even more confounding as a character by the end than in the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough when you have a book where I, you know, I can't talk about the egg because it's such a cool part of it, and I can't, you know, I don't want to.
Yeah, you talk about the egg. It's fine. Yeah. I guess if you reach this part of the podcast and you don't want spoilers, pause it, read the book, and then come back.
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, you laugh throughout the book. You laugh, you know, it's like one of those movie reviews. You laugh, you cry. But so one of the funniest lines to me was, so you can talk about Doctor's regimen and how his life started face down, then face up, and all that. That's not a spoiler. It's not contextual. But my best part was when the doctor comes out. And his diagnosis, yeah, he's in a deep sleep.
Yeah.
That's it. Which is like, right, yeah, he is.
That's so, it, yeah. Yeah, I think for whatever reason, I'm attracted to that kind of humor, like a humor of disappointment or flatness, where you expect a revelation and it's really just like the stupidest possible. I felt that way about the Yo-Yo Ma moment, which I felt like was a risk because it's so flat and weird. But I just thought there was something about Yo-Yo Ma like appearing in the book that felt so off.
It reminded me of the Seinfeld episode that Yo-Yo Ma was in.
Oh, I don't even know about that.
You watch that, it's hilarious.
Yeah, Yo-Yo Ma is like a fascinating figure to me. I mean, his music is beautiful and he's like such like a sweet, generous man. And there's also something, like, there's something kind of omnipresent about Yo-Yo Ma in this way that's, like, so strange and maybe sun-like. Yeah, so, yeah, I think to that point of the kind of punchline being that the doctor's just, oh, he's just in deep sleep. I am interested in these moments that, like, are so flat that they're kind of funny. And yeah, I think that's maybe not for everyone, but I'm attracted to that kind of humor for sure.
Yeah, well, I definitely laughed out loud on that one because, you know, you expect a diagnosis.
Right.
And I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be interesting. I wondered what it is that he's actually suffering from. But we haven't talked about his youth and sleeping because I think that's okay. That's not a spoiler. Talk about his youth and how he slept and why he changed. That's good.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that is also a sort of absurd part of the story about, so Dr. Higley's, our sort of introduction to his characters through his sleeping position, which, yeah, essentially he was a troubled adolescent, and one manifestation of that was that he slept on his stomach. And this is also personal for me because I am still a stomach sleeper. I like, it's sort of horrible the way I sleep. I like, my face is like, I don't know how I breathe.
I couldn't do that.
It's really not good for you. And so I think that was maybe the kernel of where that came from. But essentially this kind of Dr. Higley, who is this, you know, renowned scientist, at some point made this kind of decision to turn around in his sleep and sleep on his back. And he forced himself to do that. Until it became normal. And then he added this kind of extra element, which was to rest in a raw egg in its shell on his head, to balance it on his forehead as he slept. I think part of the fun there is just like this, the character of the kind of the genius and the kind of maybe the discipline that it takes to hone that genius, being as absurd as sleeping with an egg on your head. Yeah, but I think, yeah, there's, it's also, there's something visually about that symbol that feels compelling to me as well, of someone sleeping on his back with an egg, which he fries in the morning for breakfast and eats.
Also, that part in the doctrinal is Kafkaesque, like the nose or the overcoat or something like that. No, Gogol, sorry. Mm-hmm. But it's like, at first you go, well, that's really stupid, like an egg on his head, because it's not going to balance. And then I started thinking, ooh, I hope it doesn't fall off. I was worried that it was going to fall off. And then his wife is so like, again, like the Russians, his wife is so matter of fact about it. It's not like a big deal.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't, it would really take a special person to be able to sleep with an egg on his head, I think. I don't know how the physics of it work.
Well, so here's another way we don't have to spoil it. Hey, do you have the book right there by any chance?
Yeah, I could get it.
Yeah, show the cover, because, you know, you said I'm a bookseller. That's what I sell. Yeah, it's a really cool cover because it really gives an idea of absence. So did you vet it? Did you think of it? How did that work?
I mean, it was really Bestie Dogan, who does that at Melville House. I had some ideas. I liked the idea of something holographic, which comes into play in one of the chapters in the book. There's a book in the book that has a kind of circular foil. But yeah, I mean, I did want some sort of absence and something kind of refractive. But yeah, I love the cover that Bestie put together.
Melville House must really like you, because it's an expensive cover. And it's like,
you would know more about this than me. Like, yeah, do you have to really like shell out for foil?
Yeah, hell yeah. Okay. It's like giving you deckle edges.
I know, it sort of looks like a kind of like holographic Pokemon card or something. It does.
I have to tell my stepdaughter that. Because wherever we go, she checks to see if there's a Pokemon site there, you know, which I don't understand it at all. But wherever we go, there are three different guys hanging around the place, which also kind of goes to the book. They're not really there, but they're there, which goes to the brain. And it's funny because the appendix, you know, it's like the appendix is the brain, which means the brain kind of an appendix. But my favorite part, I mean, I like all the parts, because I like the hippocampus, because I like the fact that it's theoretically kind of the store of long-term memory, but kind of mediates into the cerebral cortex. But what am I thinking of? The amygdala. Mm-hmm. Because you remember that book, Free Solo, with that guy, Alex Donald, who Capitan, they did a PET scan on him too. And his amygdala was essentially absent, which is why he could just kind of, there was no fear.
The amygdala as a sort of emotional regulation, fear, fight or flight regulation. Yeah, that chapter in the book, the amygdala chapter, that was a fun one to write. It was the sort of restriction that I gave myself, was how do I write an entire chapter without any visual description or auditory. It was really all sort of haptic and proprioceptive and located within organs. And that was fun to write, because what ultimately happened was the language became quite sonic, I thought, and made sense on this kind of bodily level. And it's maybe the least narrative part of the book, and it's just kind of, I think, trying to get into the amygdala, that like region of feeling. But yeah, and then in the appendix at the end is sort of for those who want it, and maybe not everyone wants the appendix, but you know, if anyone ever feels lost, it's a good place to jump to, I think.
Yeah, it is interesting though. You don't often see that in a novel, right?
Yeah, it's weird. I wrote a weird novel. Yeah, there's like And I like it for that. I mean, I think there's something loose and foggy and fuzzy about it. There's an appendix that's just hanging off the end of it. It's a weird novel, and I like it for that reason. I think the structure is I think there's a shape to it, but it's like a very kind of fuzzy one that I think also doubles the narrator's mindset. Like the narrator is sort of in this fugue, and I think there's a similar kind of shapelessness to the book as well, which was kind of fun to write.
Another way we can get around spoilers is by talking about the maps at the beginning of the chapters, because first starts out as the city and then switches to the mind. And then what about the guys in the right-hand lower corner, which I will not talk about what they are. Because at first I looked at it and I go, okay, this is like a river or something like that. And then I go, oh, no.
It's I wanted to avoid the sort of magic school bus approach of like, okay, like we have shrunken down and we're in a brain now, which is fun, but maybe not for this book. And so for me, the maps and even just the treatment of the world and the mind, or the world and the brain, was less interested in kind of shrinking down and going inside, and more this like kind of crossfading of topography and neuroanatomy, and this kind of constant sense in which we're in both and once. We're both in a brain and we're in Arizona and we're in a mind and we're also in this narrative. And so, yeah, the illustrations, I think, point to that, to this like topography of the brain or of a city, and the way in which it's not really a one-to-one, and that we're kind of moving back and forth and in both at several points in the book.
The most disquieting thing in the book for me was the beginning and the end.
Mm-hmm.
I won't spoil, but like Tom and Pete, I'm like, mm-hmm. Okay, all right, especially at the end. So where did they come from?
What about it was disquieting? I'm curious.
Well, you got eggs, both sides, but it's because I didn't understand why they were there at first. And then I kind of made a decision about why they were there. And now that we're talking, I'm not sure again as to why mm-hmm. they're there.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me at least, I think Tom and Pete point to a subjectivity or to a world that's like outside of the rather solipsistic one that we're in. I think in a way they provide this like glimmer of escape from this solipsistic world that is in some way the pathology of the protagonist. And so I think in a way, yeah, I think what they do in some sense is just point to other characters, other worlds, other subjectivities with, you know, that. Yeah, so they're there in the beginning, and then we leave them, and they come back. And I think, you know, for me, it's just sort of a way out. It's like a kind of escape hatch for the story. It's something that is in the story, but is also outside of the story. And the way the story ends, too, without, it's not really a spoiler, but it kind of veers off into another story. That felt good. Like, it felt good to leave this world and embark on another one as a reminder that, you know, we're not stuck in just this one story.
The thing about that was really interesting was, if they were just sitting there at the counter eating eggs and joking around and going to the jukebox, yeah, but their relationship, what they were doing, especially in today's world,
mm-hmm.
in our country right now,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
could be interpreted in so many different ways, because, you know, there's no civil discourse and there's a bifurcation. Yeah. You even talked in that interview about it with that guy, the professor who's who you said would be a really good candidate for president. We can't go off on that. Go ahead.
I mean it's interesting, like Tom and Pete. I mean, in a way, I like the sort of mystique around those characters. But there's like a closeness to them. There's like a tenderness, which I think also the narrator is very much missing. I think, again, they point to another world or another subjectivity in which there's a tenderness. And whether that's like sexualized or not, I think is, you know, can remain in a sort of cloud of mystique. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I was thinking about have you ever read Players by Don DeLillo?
Yeah. I have it right here. I could point to it.
Yeah. I love that novel. And I love the way it opens. It's just, there's just kind of so much at once. They're on a plane and there's a grand piano. And I think there was something about the energy of that opening chapter that informed this one. And there was something about just Tom and Pete dancing in the middle of a diner that felt sort of so fantastic in the way that that piano on an airplane felt in Players. And it felt unexpected too for the first chapter. So yeah, I think there is something just kind of fun about it as well.
My eyes are wandering around because I'm looking for it. But I love Ratner's Star, it might have been my favorite. And then Americana. It's funny as a bookseller because I had this first edition of Americana. Mm. Someone bought it.
Oh, wow.
And then I felt really bad. I wanted to buy it back. When I first opened a bookstore, I went around to other bookstores to get advice, you know? And they said, listen, you can't be a book collector and a bookseller at the same time. And like you sleeping on your stomach, I still do it. And it's really stupid.
Yeah, so, getting high on your own supply.
Oh, the other thing about Tom and Pete is that, because you said sexualized, you handle the sex really well in the book. You know? It's like really terse, but it fits in perfectly with how he's feeling. Which then led me to believe that as a reader, again, going outside the book, which is exactly what this is all about, I'm thinking about M and I'm thinking, well, maybe there's a chance, you know, a chance, because it's such a really nice relationship and it is love both ways, as it's made very clear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking to myself, you know, maybe, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah. Yeah, totally. And also, I think, what was I going to say to that? Yeah, I think I think part of the M as just a letter allows one to kind of project a lot onto that character and for that character to take on many forms. And then yeah, as far as the sex in the book goes, it felt, yeah, especially the first moment, which I won't spoil, it felt really like true to the character. Like there's a sort of alienation that the character is experiencing. There's something kind of sad and pathetic, I think, about, and also real and true, but sad and pathetic, at least about that first instance of sex in the book, that I hope feels like that the author is trusting the reader that, okay, we can go there into this kind of sad and pathetic. I mean, it may be hot for some people, and in some ways it is, but it is mostly kind of embarrassing or pathetic. And so I do think that in that moment, it took a lot of trust in the reader to go along with it there.
Yeah, it's like under the table, you know?
Right.
And the other thing that you did in just a few paragraphs is I know that Emma's a really good person, you know, but how do I know that she is, you know? I know she's a really good person and she's trying to be kind as she can. That was well done. Cause it only, you know, she's not in there really. It's just on the floor. And
yeah,
I didn't think there'd be so many spoilers here. I can talk about this book cause it's so.
I think we're being cryptic enough that by the time someone gets through this, they'll have forgotten what all the spoilers are.
Yeah. Yes, but the thing is that you and I are talking and we both read the book and you've written the book, but no one else has. So like, are they going to be really enticed or are they going to go, what the hell are they doing?
I have no clue. Yeah.
But it's hard to paint characters. And again, a lot of other authors are good at that, to paint a character in a paragraph and have the reader feel right, because I'm right about my assessment of her, right?
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy kindness in stories. I like when characters are trying to be kind, despite maybe difficult circumstances. There's something sweet about it. I don't know. I think, I mean, so much fiction like hinges on conflict, which you need, and disagreement. But yeah, I'm a sucker for characters that are attempting kindness.
All right, well, so I'm gonna ask one more question because I could just keep asking them all day and no one's gonna listen to an hour of this. Maybe sure they will. but like Dell, again, in just a couple of paragraphs, the thing about Dell that struck me is like, he's really enthusiastic, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's how he must have been anyway, especially with his big goal, which that is a spoiler, and Dr. Higley's big goal is to do something that's impossible. But then you think, wait a minute, yeah, that's the other thing. You think, wait a minute, maybe you could do that.
No, that's right. Yeah, Dell is funny. I mean, I think originally, and in some ways, he still is. I was thinking, okay, he's the villain of the story.
Right.
There's something so kind of pathetic and even relatable to his sort of quixotic dreams that like kind of defangs him or makes him kind of endearing in his own kind of monstrous way, where he, you know, there's like a childlike quality to his ambition and his need for greatness or something. Yeah, so I think even Del Webb kind of is pathetic and kind of humbled in the book.
Yeah, but he's likable. He's likable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because he has all this enthusiasm, and that's, you know, that's compelling.
Mm-hmm.
But when you said quixotic, it's because I don't think I said it in the introduction, but it really is kind of a picaresque novel. Which is mm-hmm. because it's interior, you know, but he's traveling. He travels all over.
Yeah.
He's driving just like Don Quixote and Sancho Panza are riding, or in Candide, same thing.
Totally. Yeah. I think for as sort of nebulous and strange and in some ways experimental the book is, I mean, it's a present tense novel. It's lyrical.
First person,
it, you know, it's strange in many ways, but it also, I think, points at, you know, really old storytelling tropes as well.
Okay, I guess that's enough.
Yeah, I mean,
I really could go on because, you know, it's when you like a book that much, it's just fun. You know, like when I give it to my friends and I can put it on the table today. I'm allowed to, otherwise it would be
illegal. Like, right. You know, you get in trouble if you put it out early, right?
Yeah. Remember, mattresses do not remove under penalty of law.
Do you remember? Okay, no.
You're too young. So when you used to buy a mattress, there was a little tag that said, do not remove under penalty of law. And my brother and I would always rip the thing. We thought we were going to get arrested. That's funny. You get a box and it says, do not open before, like with Harry Potter books. But yeah, I don't really care. I put them out there. I don't know.
I've seen them out. I'm not going to tattle on any stores, but I've seen them out early.
Yeah. Okay. Well, like I said, you're going to be downtown on the 6th on Passyunk. Novel idea. So, yeah, perhaps we can talk while you're in Philadelphia. I would love to. And thanks so much for being here and for writing the book.
I'd love to do that too. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on. Yeah. I feel like we didn't spoil too much today.
No, we were good. I think we were good.
Yeah.
All right. I'll talk to you soon then.
Sounds good. Yeah. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.